Okay, it's really a pleasure to be here today, and we're continuing our learning together. I just want to recap a little of what we did last week, because that's very important going forward. Last week, we did the Iyun of Nechama Leibovitz that spoke about Vataneh Sarah, right? Vataneh Sarai Vativrach Mipaneh, which means the Sarai treated Hagar in a certain way, and Hagar escapes, right? Runs away. Now, the question that we had was, what does this imply for the future? And also, what does this mean about the behavior of Sarai? And what's important for us to see is what Nechama Leibovitz did with this. What she did was she brought traditional parshanim, traditional commentaries on the Torah, and she really picks an idea from each one and puts it together into this bigger idea. So in a sense, she's really giving us, in the end, her own original idea, but it's based on these traditional views. So last week, what we saw with this Iyun is that Nechama used mostly traditional perushim, mostly traditional commentaries. She brought in Ramban originally to show the extreme selfless relationship between the two, the altruistic relationship that each one was willing to do for the other in this unbelievable way, capacity of love and generosity. Number two, though, once this act was done, Hagar behaves in a very cruel way to Sarai. And she makes fun of Sarai, and she puts her down. And not only that, she impugns her personality and character. She says, oh, what she shows to the outside is not really what she is inside, which means she's two-faced. Hagar, according to Rashi, is criticizing Sarai to the very essence of who she is. Radak is saying, but still, what should have been Sarai's response? She should have been moral and ethical and should have had a higher standard of morality and not given in to this. And it was wrong what Sarai did. And Ramban explained that Avraham, because he let Sarai, and Sarai, when they did this, this causes the Ishmaelim, Islam, and the Muslims to constantly, and the Arabs, to constantly have this battle with Bnei Israel, which means once we behave this way, there has to be a balance. So what Nechama does is she presents these traditional parshanim, and she presented one interesting idea. She said, oh, in the code of Hammurabi, this idea of giving your maidservant is very common. But what Nechama Leibovitz wanted to show is that in the Torah, we have a totally different attitude. So she brings an outside source, but she wants to show that we have different attitudes towards this kind of behavior. So she wants to bring it as a contrast. But in the end, Nechama's main point of this whole Iyun is to show that when you do something altruistic and you put yourself out there, there are going to be negative consequences. And your job as a moral and ethical person and an upstanding individual is that you have to live up to it. That you have to live up to that unbelievable altruistic action that you did, even if it's going to hurt you. And even if there's going to be backlash. And what's fascinating is that we see one of the main things that Nechama wants to show in Iyunim is that there is a moral and ethical lesson. Every time you learn something in Torah, it has to give you a life lesson. You have to take away something specific from it. So today we're going to do something from the Iyunim Chadashim in Sefer Shmot. So in the Hebrew, we're starting on page 18. And I'm going to give the sources from the Hebrew, right? You see on the bottom, even though there's page 29 on the copies, but you see there's 18 on the side for the pagination. And then page 21 and on, you could look at the English. So you'll be able to see the translation, even though, of course, I'm going to translate and discuss. Nechama's Iyunim and Sefer Breshit are mostly taken from her gilyonot, the sheets that she put out, as we discussed in our first class, that she spread and people would answer them, and then she would respond and mark them. And this became a real interesting phenomenon. In her Iyunim Chadashim B'Sefer Shmot, the volume that we're starting to learn today, are Iyunim Chadashim, are new perspectives on Sefer Shmot. So Nechama is going to add a lot of interesting outside sources and put together this whole new idea, which means not only use the Iyunim that she used earlier, But she is going to extend these iyunim to really bring more sources. And we're going to see that throughout our next classes together. So she does this later. She includes other sources outside of the classical purview that she mostly uses in the iyunim in Sefer Breshit. So we're going to do Nechama's classic iyun. And not like Nechama, I'm going to give you her punchline in the beginning so we can then see how she gets to it. Because we're not only learning Nechama's iyunim, we're trying to see her approach. So what Nechama's going to do, like she did in iyunim in Sefer Breshit, but here even more so, Nechama's going to take a classic idea. When we talk about the miyaldot, the midwives in Mitzrayim, and we talk about Shifra and Pua, who are the classical individuals that the Midrash says are Shifra and Pua? Right? Yocheved and Miriam. We all know that. What Nechama is going to do, she's going to show from the text and interesting Parshanut, she is going to show that the Mialdot, Ha'ivriot, which we're going to do word for word, at least in the original Psukim, are not what we think the classical view that Miriam and Yocheved are Shifra and Pua, but that they are actually Egyptian. They are actually Egyptian midwives who helped the Jewish women. And I'm going to leave the punchline of why she does this to the end. But she is going to build this. So I'm telling you this idea because you have to see how she builds this she'or to get to that conclusion. So let's open it up. I'm going to do from 18. You can do in the English to follow along. Nechama classically brings in psukim. She brings in psukim in the Torah because her first goal and main goal is for us to understand what the psukim say. In our earlier iyun, it was, what does it mean that Sarah tortured? And really, Nechama wanted to ask, why? Here, she's going to try to ask the question, who are these midwives? That's the main idea that Nechama wants to address. And again, it's textual. So let's start with the beginning. Melech Mitzrayim speaks to the Miyaldot Ha'ivriot, the midwives Ha'ivriot. It's hard to translate in English because once I do it, I'm already going in one direction or the other. But the midwives, is it of the Hebrews? Or is it the midwives who are Hebrews? So it's not clear in the Pasuk, is it the midwives of the Hebrews? Or is it the midwives who are Hebrews? So Nechama is really going to focus on that idea. So again, remember, Nechama is usually looking for a question in the Pshat, and then she's going to evaluate it. She's going to evaluate it bringing commentaries. Last time she brought classical commentaries, but came up with her own interesting idea in the end. Here we're going to see that she's going to split the iyun into two. Number one, she's going to bring you the classical commentaries, and then what is she going to say after that? But there's this other view. So let's see. So Melech Mitzrayim speaks to the Mialdot, who either are the Mialdot, the midwives, who tend to the Hebrews, or the midwives who are Hebrews. And what are their names? Shifra. Shem Ha'achat, the one, is Shifra. V'shem Ha'shenit, the second one, is Pua. You see, in translation, it doesn't work exactly, because in Hebrew, we have what's called Hei Ha'yidiyah. We use a Hei to say the one, the known one. So it doesn't say Shem Achat Shifra, V'shem She'nit Pua. It doesn't say one and the other is Shifra Pua. The one is Shifra, and the other is Pua. And what does Melech Mitzrayim say? When you help the Hebrews, Bialdechem et ha'ivriot, when you assist them, the Hebrews, give birth, when you see on the birthstone, if it's a son, kill him, and if it's a daughter, you could let her live. The next pasuk, Vatir ena ha'mialdot et ha'elokim. But these midwives feared Hashem. The lo asu kasher diber alehem Melech Mitzrayim. So they feared Hashem, and they don't do what Melech Mitzrayim said. We can interpret this two ways. One is that they had fear of heaven. They had Yirat Hashem. So when you usually say Yirat Hashem, where would you put this person in what category? Jewish. Right? What does Hashem say to Avraham after the Akedah? Atayadati ki Yirei Elokimata. Now I know you're God-fearing. So one way to interpret this is clearly they are Hebrews. They are Jewish. Because they have fear of Hashem. Huh. But another way to interpret this is, what did Avraham say to Avimelech when he said, my wife Rivka is really my sister? He said, Rak ein yirat Elokim b'makom hazeh. But there's no fear of heaven, and they're going to kill me about my wife. Now, Avram doesn't think Avimelech in Gerar is Jewish or Hebrew, but there is this idea that if you fear Hashem, you have this universal moral code. So we have two ideas in these psukim that can either say these midwives are absolutely Hebrew, because the Hebrew women, they stand up to power, and they are willing to do anything for their children, and that's why we're going to go with, of course these midwives are Hebrew, or are we going to say, no, these midwives are Egyptian, but they had a fear of Hashem. They feared Hashem, and that's why they were able to stand up to Paro. These are our two options. So let's see what Nechama does with this. Now, Nechama, in her earlier iyun, right before the iyun that we're studying together, does a beautiful job of bringing in the Ramban to explain what was the destruction in Egypt. What was going on in Egypt? And Ramban, hundreds of years before we experienced, or our parents or grandparents, right, experienced the Holocaust, the Jewish people experienced the Holocaust, writes this unbelievable piece. What was Paro doing? Slowly but surely, he was dehumanizing the Jews, Bnei Israel, the Ivrim, in the eyes of the Egyptians. And as a result, what were the Egyptians able to do? Look at the Jews, at Bnei Israel as vermin. Look at them as the other. And not have any kind of emotional connection with them, because they were not people. You could do whatever you want to them, enslave them, because you don't look at them like people. And when you read it, you really see that's what Nazi Germany did. It dehumanized the Jews. So the whole atmosphere in Egypt was, we don't look at the Jews as humans. So what is Nechama really doing already before we even read this iyun? And she's giving you this little introduction. If we read the earlier iyun, and I'm giving you the summary, and she's referring to it, she already wants you to be in the mindset of discrimination and Holocaust when you are reading this iyun. By just introducing this iyun with the iyun of Ramban earlier, and by just putting this in this earlier paragraph, do you see the first paragraph where she comments? She is saying, remember in the earlier iyun where we talked about the Ramban and what Paro did? Right? How did they get to the point where they're killing children and they want to throw them into the Yaor? It's because Paro was so successful in this dehumanizing of Bnei Israel. So now she said, okay, but let's turn to the Mialdot. But you get how she already puts you in a certain mindset when she says, remember that Ramban? And she says, and now let's get to the Mialdot question. But she's already putting in your mind this reference, which is very important for her Iyun. So she asks, who are the Mialdot? As we said, what's the traditional view? She brings in the traditional sources. She brings in the Gemara in Sota. The Gemara in Sota says, Rav and Shmuel are arguing. Who are these midwives? Either it's a mother and daughter, or it's a mother and daughter-in-law. Mother and daughter would be Yocheved and Miriam. Mother and daughter-in-law would be Miriam and Elisheva. Yocheved and Elisheva. But we all know, what is the more traditional view that really took off and that most of the Mefarshim quote? Shifra and Pua are Yocheved and Miriam. So Nechama goes on. Now I'm on page 19 in the sources that you have. Nechama says, look, we have this Gemara, and who's quoting this Gemara? Rashi is quoting this Gemara. What does Rashi say? Dibur hamatchil Shifra. Zu Yocheved. Who is Shifra? Yocheved is Shifra. Al shem shemishaperet et havlad. All of us agree that Shifra, the name of Shifra, refers to Yocheved because she makes the baby beautiful. So Shifra means Yocheved, which means Shifra is Yocheved because of the action that Shifra does. The midwives work together as a team. One makes the baby beautiful and one will speak to the baby. And Rashi says, Dibura matchil pua. How could you have, if it's Shifra and pua, are Yocheved and Miriam, what should it mean? What should it say? It should say Miriam and Yocheved. Why does it say Shifra and pua? Why are we using nicknames? Right? So Rashi's explaining, just like the Gemara. He's totally quoting the Gemara. Ah, pua zo Miriam. Why? Al shem shepoa umidaberet vahogala vlad. Because when the baby comes out, what does Miriam do? She speaks to the baby, she talks to the baby, she bonds with the baby. See, they knew a lot of the stuff that we think we're so modern today. You know, what's so important, bonding, that first moment when the baby comes out. So that's why they have nicknames. Not only because Shifra and Pua, right? Because they're midwives, but because of the actions that they do as midwives, and that's why we have nicknames. So Rashi and the Gemara, right, going Rashi's after the Gemara, are saying, nicknames, don't worry about nicknames. And then she brings an interesting idea that Yitzchak Heinemann, who was a more modern scholar, he's in the 1900s, and he was a very interesting scholar, and he says, look, why does the Midrash many times ascribe individuals where we know their names to others where we don't know who they are and says it's the same person? We have this in many different places in Tanakh, as we know. So what does Yitzchak Heinemann say? We have this idea of conservation of personalities. The Midrash, many times when you have two individuals who are mentioned, but we don't know anything about them, and we have other individuals mentioned close by, so usually the Midrash will connect the two. And it's called conservation of personalities, which means the Midrash usually uses and connects people to the people that we already know. So Nechama Leibovitz is explaining why we have in the Midrash this idea of, Shifra and Pua are Yocheved and Miriam, which means the Midrash does that in many places. But still the question is, and Nechama asks, according to Nechama, Rashi would only bring a midrash if there's a real difficulty in the text. So here, Shifra and Pua, it's enough to say that Shifra and Pua, we don't know who they are, so Rashi wants to let you know what's the difficulty. Who are Shifra and Pua? Yes, we're going according to the midrash that it's Yocheved and Miriam. But Nechama still is asking the question, and we're on the middle paragraph in this Iyun, and Nechama is still asking, but why would he pick this midrash? So the Re'eim, and this is also a very important thing with Nechama Leibovitz brought in a lot of super commentaries of Rashi. Nechama Leibovitz was a huge Rashi fan. And Nechama Leibovitz felt, Rashi usually brings pshat. When he brings a midrash, there has to be a reason in the text, in the psukim, that push Rashi to bring this midrash. So Rav Eliyahu Mizrahi is a super commentary on Rashi. He was from the 16th century. He wrote a super commentary on Rashi. And while doing that, he also analyzes Rashi. And we'll talk about him in another iyun that we're going to be doing together. But the point is, Rav Eliyahu Mizrahi says, why did Rashi bring in this midrash? So he says, because this is a Kabbalah type of midrash. Now, when I say Kabbalah type of midrash, we don't mean a Kabbalistic type of midrash. When he says this is v'yitachen shaita Kabbalah bi'adam, she's quoting the Re'eim, Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi, saying that. The point is that there are certain midrashim that have a very strong Masorah and tradition, and they have an acceptance. So really, this medrash that Miriam and Yocheved are Shifra and Pua is a very established midrash. So for Nechama and whichever parshanim are going against this midrash is a very uphill climb, which means the traditional view is Miriam and Yocheved are Shifra and Pua, Shifra and Pua are Miriam and Yocheved. Eliyahu Mizrahi, super commentary on Rashi, says, why is Rashi quoting this? Because this is one of the most accepted traditions that we have in Midrash. Because there are two ways of Midrash. One, that it's Parshanut. The Chachamim look at the Psukim and come out with ideas. We also have the idea in Medrash that this is a Kabbalah. This is a long-standing tradition. It's a Mesorah. So it's pretty hard to go against one of those Midrashim. But Nechama says, still, that's not enough for her. that Rashi takes this midrash. There has to be a deeper reason why Rashi picks Miriam and Yocheved to be Shifra and Pua. And then she brings in the Maharsha. The Maharsha is a very important parshan of Agadot. Very well known. His name is Shmuel Idels in the 16th century. And he said, as I mentioned earlier, he says, why is Shifra and Pua seen as Yocheved and Miriam? Because there's a difficulty. Why do we say Shem Ha'achat Shifra? V'Shem Ha'Shenit Pua? It seems like we know them already. The one is Shifra, the other one is Pua, which means it has to be people that we know. And then in the next perek, what do we have? Miriam and Yocheved spoken about. So what would you think? Done. We did the whole Iyun. Who are Shifra and Pua? Clearly Yocheved and Miriam. But Nechama is going to go in the opposite direction. She's going to say, yes, this is the traditional view. And even Ibn Ezra, she doesn't mention it, but I'm adding it to you. She just mentions him. But the point is, Ibn Ezra is usually a Pashtan. He usually likes to do Pshat. But he's bringing this Midrash because it has a lot of weight. So for Nechama to go against this Midrash is already going in a very interesting direction. So how does Nechama do that? So let's look. We're on page of 19, but we're on page 31. So on the second column in page 19. If you look in the middle section, what is Nechama going to say? She's saying, V'nifne ata lamasoret hashniya. I'm on column 2, which is page 31 on page 19 in the Hebrew. You could look in the English, but here we are. V'nifne ata lamasoret hashniya. Now, this is fascinating by Nechama. It is the, it would be like the beginning of a third paragraph, or the bold words on column 2, which is 31. What is fascinating about Nechama's use of the words V'nifne ata lamasoret hashniya? What Nechama is doing is saying, okay, we have the masoret of Rashi, of the Gemara, Miriam and Yocheved are Shifra and Pua. Now she's saying, oh, but I have another tradition. Now that's fascinating to do that because this is not a really strong tradition. But she's going to say, no, I'm going to show you another old tradition. Why is it an old tradition? Because she's going to say, oh, I have sources that are very old. And she's going to bring in Philo, who is a big philosopher, who was tenuously Jewish, right? Tenuously traditional, in Egypt, in the first century before Common Era. And she brings in Josephus. And Josephus, in his book of Antiquities, which he wrote, remember, he was the traitor in the destruction of the Second Temple, who then gives up where the Jews are hiding, goes to Rome, then writes histories of the Jews, but he also wants to find favor in the eyes of the Roman Empire. And he writes in his Antiquities, and Philo writes as well, that who are Shifra and Pua? They are non-Jews. They are non-Jews. They are non-Jews who are the midwives for the Jewish women. And they do this because they are going against what the king wants. So Nechama is saying, oh, I did find two interesting early sources, and that's Josephus and that's Philo. So right away, what's very interesting, what kind of sources is she using? Non-traditional sources, right, to say the least. So she is saying, oh, I have a very good source that they are non-Jewish, and it goes very early. And she says very interestingly that why does she think Josephus is a good source, even though he's a traitor and even though he is writing this in Rome? Because it must be that when he's writing his Antiquities, what is he basing a lot of his material on? His experience in the Cheder when he was younger. It must be that he's pulling on those traditions when he is writing this. So Nechama is using Josephus as a traditional, acceptable source. Again, fascinating, right? Very different than the Iyun that we did last time. And further, she says, and I also found another interesting Midrash, Tadshe. And Midrash Tadshe is also a late Midrash. It's not really a Medrash in the classical sense. It's a Parshan. But the Midrash Tadshe, which is a little late, says, oh, maybe they were converts because they feared Hashem. So they must be converts, and they're in our list of the special converts. Hagar, Osnat, Tzipora, Shifra, and Puah. So now Nechama showed, not only do I have Philo and Josephus, but I even have a good source that they were converts. And we also have the Imre Noam, also an interesting Perush, 1500s, which is a super commentary on Rashi as well, where he also says, they were converts. Now again, these are not mainstream at all, but she is looking at all these different parshanim that we start having this tradition. Now, where do you think that tradition could come from, that they're converts, that Shifra and Puah might be converts? What is the famous midrash? I mean, again, we're going beyond the Nechama Leibovitz here. What is the famous midrash about Batya Bat Paro? That she was a convert. What was she doing when she saw Moshe? She was coming to convert. So we already have this tradition. If you're doing something good for the Jews, right, what must it be, right, that you saw Hashem and you're converting? Not necessarily, right, that you're non-Jewish. So Nechama has these two ideas now that she's working with. On the one hand, she's working with the idea that they're non-Jews, that she still has to prove, how could that work, and also that they are converts. So which way is Nechama going to go? So let's go to the next page number 20, but I'm on column 32, I'm on the first column. She's bringing, to again bolster her idea, she brings in Shaddal. Shaddal is Shmuel David Luzzatto from 1800 to 1865. Now, this is also very interesting. She's bringing Shaddal, and what is she bringing in Shaddal? She's bringing in Shaddal, again, page 20, column 32, right? Page 32, we're doing the top. You could look also in English, you find Shaddal. What is the view of Shaddal? Now, Shaddal is a very interesting commentator to bring, because Shaddal is in Italy, doing a lot of Wissenschaftliches Judentum work, doing a lot of biblical studies. He is really seen as kind of like a proto-conservative. He had very traditional views, but not necessarily orthodox in the way that we think about it. And he had interesting views about Torah and Tanakh. So he's kind of like borderline. But he was a big fighter against biblical criticism. And Nechama, if you see that the Torah is all as one, and you really look at it as one unit, then she is going to accept your ideas, and she's going to say, and this is what we said in our first class, which is a very interesting approach of Nechama, she says, anyone who says truth, if I feel that it's true and it could enhance the learning, then I bring him in. Now, this also was very interesting and controversial. She got a lot of letters, because are we only evaluating if you said something true or good and we're quoting you? Do we look to the hashkafa or background of the person who is writing these opinions? And this is really a flashpoint with Nechama. And in academics, so you look at everybody, because academics is not really laden with hashkafa and with a religious overlook, right? But what about if you're teaching and you want to teach these ideas? So that was the pushback. And she said, but if I read something and I find it's a good idea, I quote it, right? And I don't want to drink from water and then poison the well and claim that I didn't look there, and I want to be honest. And this was a very big debate that Nechama Leibovitz had with many individuals, and it's very interesting. Rav Kupperman, who was a big fan of Nechama Leibovitz and really was inspired, in his own words, he says, to really establish Michlala as a result of her giving these classes, and saw, you know, also her shita of, you know, learning in depth. But he said that, but he feels it's important that we really limit what the sources that you can use in class are and what that teaches the students. And he wanted Nechama to teach in Michlala, but he said, but you have to go according to these rules, and she refused. So that is very interesting. So this really is a big flashpoint. Yes.
Sorry, could you say who that was again?
Yes, it's Shmuel David Luzzatto.
So, is that a relation to Reb Chaim Luzzatto?
I don't know, all the way back.
Oh, okay.
It
so
it could be, but you know, like Cohen and Cohen, even though Luzzatto's not so far. Right. Good question, though. But if you read how she's quoting Shaddal, you see that a lot of the ideas that she's bringing in, she got from Shaddal. So she wants to acknowledge him. I read his book. I'm getting ideas from it. I'm going to be honest, and I'm going to quote him. But again, the question is, she's writing these Iyunim Chadashim. She's writing it for teachers. What should teachers really teach? She's writing it for the public. And these are the big flashpoints of education. What sources do you bring in? Who are your authorities? Should there be a distinction in the sources that you use, especially if you're trying to teach Torah? Is the hashkafa of the Torah scholars that you bring very important? Right? In my opinion, absolutely yes. Right? And in my classes, when I teach Nechama Leibovitz, the whole point is to see where the big seismic shifts or where the fault line are between the different schools of thought and different contexts in where you teach. So look who she is quoting. She's quoting the Shaddal. And what is she quoting Shaddal? She wants to show that Shaddal also already divided this idea of the Mialdot into these two pieces. So what is she really doing? She's confessing. Right? Where did I get a lot of my idea for this Iyun? From Shaddal. And I'm going to quote Shaddal. So he says, look, Shaddal says, and she's quoting, the view of Chazal and Inklus and Rashbam and Ramban, that they were from Zera Yisrael. But what is the view of others? But Hieronymus, Josephus Flavius, Abarbanel says that they were Mitzriot, they were Egyptian. And then Shaddal goes into all these linguistic debates. But in the end, what is Shaddal's proof? Shaddal wants to say, what does Vatirena Hamialdot et Elokim mean here? That they were God-fearing. And if they were Hebrews, what wouldn't we have to say, according to Shaddal? That they were God-fearing. Because what would be the assumption? They're God-fearing. They're Hebrews, right? So that is his proof. But Nechama, look at the bottom of page 32, says she doesn't like that enough. That, just being God-fearing, right, is enough, because you could sometimes fear God and have negative views and want to crush the Jews, like the Crusades and others. So just being God-fearing, because your religion could tell you, right, to do bad to the Jews, it doesn't always mean you're going to do good things. So Nechama is saying, when the Torah talks about Yirat Elokim, it means a very specific universal moral code. So look at the top of page 33. What is Nechama saying? Nechama is bringing this idea, and now she wants to get a little more specific. When you have Yirat Elokim, when you have fear of heaven, what's a very important criteria? That you also have a moral and ethical code. Because some religions can lead you to do a terrible thing. So just being God-fearing, and if you look back at the little words of Shaddal, he says, Ye Elokei Emet o Elokei Sheker. Right? It could be either a true God or not true God. But if you're God-fearing, that already puts you in a certain category. And Nechama disagrees. She says, just saying I'm God-fearing is not enough. You have to be God-fearing with certain qualifications and a certain moral and ethical code. And where do we see that? We see that already with Abraham. That's why I gave you the introduction. We see that already with Abraham. When Abraham says, Achen yirat Elokim b'makom hazeh v'haraguni al dvar ishti, we're on top of page 33, what is he saying? You don't even have to be Hebrew, but you have to have a fear of Hashem, but with a moral and ethical code. There has to be this universal moral and ethical code that we expect all people on this earth to really follow in order to be moral and ethical. So you don't have to be Hebrew. You don't only have to be Jewish, But there has to be this universal moral and ethical code, and that's what Yirat Elohim is. It doesn't just mean you fear God. You have to fear God in the right way, with moral and ethical codes, because sometimes religions can lead you astray. And what do we see? What does it say about Amalek? Look at the next quote from Nechamah. What do we say about Amalek? Asher korcha baderech, right? They attacked you on the way. Vayizanev b'cha kol ha-nechshalim acharecha. And they really attacked all of the weak. Va'ata ayef v'yagea v'lo yare Elohim. And not God-fearing. And the question is, on whom is that phrase? Is it on Bnei Yisrael, that we were not God-fearing yet? Or does it mean Amalek? And we have a lot of views that the whole point of Amalek is that they don't fear God, and they think everything is mikre, and they don't think that there is a higher purpose and a higher goal. And that's why Amalek is one of our biggest enemies. And the idea of Amalek, right, even though there are no humans today who are Amalek, but the idea of that immorality and the idea that you don't think that there's any moral code in this world is one of our biggest enemies. So Nechamah now is going to move back to our Holocaust metaphor. What is Nechamah really wanting to say here? She is saying, and very, very astutely, and this is classic Nechamah. She is saying, look at the last paragraph. What does she want to say? She wants to say, Vatir'ena ha-mialdot et ha-lokim, that the mialdot fear Hashem, and the idea that they're mialdot mitzriot, she wants to say, yes, they're not mialdot who were Hebrew, who were helping the Hebrews. She wants to say, no, they were Egyptians who were helping the Hebrews, which means in every era when there is oppression and the majority is saying to hate the Jews, what do we expect of the non-Jews? That there will be righteous Gentiles. Which means if you say when the Jews are in trouble that who's the only people that we can look to are other Jews, then we're saying that nobody else cares and no one else is moral and ethical. What is the expectation of Nechamah? During the Holocaust, what should have happened? Righteous Gentiles and the nation should have stood up and gone against this. The Nazis themselves should have stood up against it. We expect that people have a moral and ethical code and will stand up against the oppressor. So for Nechamah, the idea that the Mialdot were Mitzriot, that they're righteous Gentiles, is so compelling, which means that's what we expect in this world, that the non-Jews should feel this moral ethical code and should not be bystanders, but should be upstanders. That's like the new phrase that is used in Holocaust education today. So let's read the last pieces of Nechamah. And this is the classical Nechamah. What's the message she wants to teach in this Iyun? Nechamah always has a message that we expect the world and other people, you have to live up to your moral and ethical codes. We expect that of you because you have to have fear of Hashem. You have to have that moral and ethical code. So what is she saying? If we accept, im nekabel, so I'm 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines from the top in the last paragraph on page 33. Im nekabel et fisato shel haRamban, remember, she put it in the context of the Ramban, not saying Holocaust, Holocaust, but if you know how to read this, she meant Holocaust, read all this Iyun within that text, within that context. Shiratza paro lasot et hakol beseter. He wanted to do everything quietly, right? To oppress the Jews in a way in the beginning that no one would really realize. You take the baby boys and you kill them. Shelo yivadaki mimenu haHamas. He'ach yifne el mialdot ivriot. Right? How is he going to go to the Hebrew midwives? How are they going to be in collusion with him? If this oppression is going on, how does he even think that he's going to get the Hebrew midwives to collude with him? Right? So she's saying, oh, if that's true, that there's no way he could have asked Mialdot Ivriot. But again, unfortunately, what do we know during the Holocaust? Unfortunately, even Jews collaborated because you want to save, your own life. And also, who would be the midwives for the Hebrews? Probably Hebrew women, because they're the ones who were around them, and they're the ones who took care of them. But she wants to say, yesh latet et hadat Al kol, al kach, excuse me, shatora mar'a lanu betoch yam shel resha va'aritzut, in the sea of evil and oppression. Nechama is saying, you're thinking Mitzrayim, she's also telling you, think Holocaust. V'dafka, besamuch lepasuk yud gimel, hamar'e et Mitzrayim birishutam, showing the extensive evil of throwing all the boys in, wanting to kill all the boys. Ketzad yachol haprat la'amod neged harishut. How an individual could stand up against oppression, which means Nechama wants to show that every individual has a responsibility to stand up against oppression. Now, on one hand, you could say it was amazing that the Jewish women stood up against oppression, and they stood up against Paro. And the whole point of Miriam, she's always speaking her mind. She's speaking and saying what she thinks. She runs up to Bat Paro. So according to the Medrash, clearly we can see that Shifra and Puah are Miriam and Yocheved, or at least Hebrew midwives, because the women are always standing up. The Hebrew women are always standing up to protect their children, no matter what. But for Nechama, she wants to teach a different lesson. She wants to teach the lesson that the nations are responsible. Everyone is responsible, morally and ethically. What's your job? Lihitkomem lipkuda lo litzayetla. Not to follow orders. What was the whole piece in Germany? And what did everyone say? I was just following orders, right? I didn't do this myself. The pressure, and I was just following orders. So that's her whole inyun. She wants to say, you go against the pressure. You can't get away from the responsibility by saying, I got an order from my king, which means everybody has their personal responsibility. And ein tzadikut or rishut, being just or evil, it doesn't have to do with hishtaychut leumit or gizit. It doesn't really rely, your justice and the way you behave as an evil person should not rely on your ethnic group or on your religious group or on your nationality. Meaning, what does Nechama want to say? If we say the Mialdot were Hebrews, then what do we say? I'm responsible for my type because they're my type and I care about them. What does Nechama want to show? What is this whole Inyan of Bat Paro, which she doesn't bring in, but we're bringing in, and the Mialdot want to show that everyone has responsibility. You should never give in if there's evil around you. You always have to step up. And no matter what. Ukeshem sheyatzu Rut v'Na'ama mimo'av u'me'amon, ken kach hayu shtei tzidkaniyot eile mimitzrayim. So in the end, she's ambiguous. Is she going in the end that they eventually converted? Or that they stayed Egyptian? She's kind of hinting that, oh, and we know many righteous women who left their nationalities and their religions and then joined us, but she leaves that as kind of an interesting comment. So here is a classic iyun of Nechama, wanting to teach this idea, but she shows how it's really rooted in the words, but she's going against the classical view, and she wants to do that because she wants to show her her idea. Yes.
So, but if that's her point, then why wouldn't the Torah have said Mitzriot? Like, just like they say Moaviot. If they're trying to praise the Mitzri women for doing something like this, then it would be written in the Torah. Why would that not be written? In other words, if her point...
She's saying, no, the Mialdot HaIvriot, the midwives of the Egyptians, of the Hebrews, and because Paro could not logically ask Hebrews to do that, then it's Mitzriot.
Right, but why not put the word?
She's working hard to show that it's Pat. Right, that's why, what's the traditional...
I understand her point, but I don't see what... Because I understand why I wouldn't say Hebrews, because that's what it looks like. So, but if you're specifically saying to praise these women that went against their king and went and were Uriel, why would you put that?
Right, and that's why we have... Your point is, and that's why Bat Paro, it's very obvious.
Right.
She's Bat Paro and she goes against her...
Right, and it says Maviot. Right. It's a praise to these people, so why wouldn't you put it?
It's a good question. As we said, we're asking questions. But this is her iyun.
But isn't it what you said, that she always tries to teach us a moral lesson? So the question is really, it is ambiguous, and the ambiguity is there, and you could learn it that way. But what is the lesson really to learn from this? It wouldn't be really a lesson, because we know that Jewish women would stand up, and the Jewish women did stand up for their own. But the lesson really that we're trying to learn from this and from this section is that in a world of evil, every person has a responsibility to stand up and do the right thing. Because she's looking for what is the lesson.
Other comments?
Yeah, so I sort of to answer what you're saying, I think also the lesson that I think Nechama wants us to learn is that maybe even when sometimes it looks like the whole world is against us and we think we have nobody, there's always going to be some righteous Gentiles out there. And maybe those will be the, you know, we can't do it by ourselves. So maybe that's what she's pointing out. That even in a world of evil, you'll still find someone more than likely.
Wait. You want to hear everybody.
Next question. And I'd like to address her question. That's exactly the kind of learning you've been having all along. But what you're really asking is, why did Hashem use those words? And that question is exactly what you've been learning. The Torah has layers. The Torah has different meanings. In different times, it gives you a different message. We're peeling back different layers. This is Nechama peeling it back according to the way she wants to. Hashem did it for that reason, that it has everything in there. It's all there. You've got to know how to interpret it. But now we have the people interpreting it, and we're seeing how Nechama interpreted it.
But it depends on the sources.
Right. And also here, it's very interesting that she's using these sources. Now, Abarbanel and Malbim actually do say... Abarbanel and Malbim actually do say that the Mitzriot were non-Jewish. That the Miyaldot were non-Jewish. So ask me, how come she doesn't bring them in? Because they both say that either they were bribed by the Jewish husbands to do it, or they were forced in other way, and that's why she wants to bring it that they did it out of free will. But even the Malbim and Abarbanel and Malbim are also unusual, but they bring it up because of the possibility, the language possibility. I see this, I actually think that the Mialdot are Hebrew. I mean, my opinion is that the Mialdot are Hebrew, and the whole point is that, you know, the Jewish women, you know, have to be proactive, and then we have Bat Paro as the, the outside source. Yeah.
Wouldn't it say that they converted? Mm-hmm. Because... why would they be doing what they were doing, two women alone, like Egyptian women, completely isolated, and for what reason? For morality?
That's the point. Abarbanel and Malbim say, no, it had to be some, money involved. And my mother also, righteous Gentiles, but, my grandfather bribed everybody in order to save the family. Okay, one more comment, and then... we'll go, but we have many more Eunim to do, and they're all fascinating. Yes?
What about, I don't know if it's a Medrash or whatever, that they were rewarded, Shifra and Puah, right?
Vayas lahem batim.
As Yochavet and Miriam.
Right. Livia, Kehuna, Malchut.
Because of this, because they were the Mialdos, but right. If they weren't, then why were they rewarded?
Right, because that is a whole line of Midrash.
So
a beautiful midrash, and that shows when you do something, you always get sachar for it.
How does she explain that they were rewarded if she's not explaining that that's who they were?
Midrash.
It's midrash.
That is a whole line of midrash, and again, Abarbanel and Malbim also, say this view. So there is, makom. There is a place. For it, even though the overwhelming traditional view is that Shifra and Pua are Yocheved and Miriam, or at least, Hebrew midwives.
So anyone who's learning Nechama, basically, are Jewish people. So this message to the other nations is message to us, actually. So what is the purpose of her message? To what? Instill hope in us? The point, it's a beautiful perspective. But the perspective is that even in, like what Kiki said, even in a world of evil, the sea of evil, there are still people that are righteous. The message should be to the nations that they have a responsibility, no matter what their faith is, to be upstanding. What's the point of telling us that? To what trust
or to believe that there's hope? Like, what's the message? It's to us.
Okay, so we're going to...
learning it is us.
Excellent question. We're going to see in some other Iyunim that she flips it, in the sense that in the Holocaust, we were the victims. But now we have our own nation, and sometimes we might be the oppressors, and we also have a responsibility. But we are going to do other Iyunim and see some of her bigger ideas. Thank you.
I don't know why, from as a child, I remember learning, they, I thought it was...